From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an Ypsilanti mother and daughter face being deported to Mexico tomorrow morning, leaving another daughter behind.
It's very devastating. I don't think anybody would like to be separated from their family.
Dan Gilbert's latest plans for downtown Detroit, a high-rise on the old Hudson site and a soccer stadium on the unfinished Wayne County Jail site.
This is going to be the first time where Dan Gilbert is actually able to put his own stamp on a downtown building by building one.
He grew up an underachieving student in Grand Rapids, then Jack Clifford went on to found the Food Network.
There were plenty of sports channels. There were plenty of news channels. You name it, women's channels, men's channels. But there was no food channel.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Without action by the Immigration Board of Appeals, an Ypsilanti mother and her 16-year-old daughter could be deported back to Mexico tomorrow morning, leaving behind an 11-year-old sister. I'm Cynthia Canty. We'll have more on that story in 20 minutes. But first, it is time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, here with us via Skype. And we're looking at Dan Gilbert's two newest ideas for downtown Detroit. We'll start with his proposal for the Hudson's site on Woodward. We ought to remind everyone, the venerable department store closed in 1993, and then it was imploded in 98. Right now, the site is an underground garage. Your thoughts about this proposed mixed-use high-rise?
Well, I think it's going to happen. I don't think there's any question about that. You know, this is going to be the first time where Dan Gilbert is actually able to put his own stamp on a downtown building by building one. All these other efforts that he's done, you know, $2.2 billion spread around acquiring and renovating about 90 properties in downtown has all been about existing real estate. And this is going to be an opportunity for him to make an iconic and signature statement. And I have every expectation that he'd do that. You know, Dan Gilbert finances a lot of his real estate, if not all of his real estate efforts, largely with cash, and then does some financing, packages up various buildings. But the reason he's able to do a lot of this stuff, and you don't hear a lot of stories of, well, this fell through and this didn't happen, is because of the financial power that he has behind him and his ability to move ahead with things that other kinds of developers don't have the luxury of doing, particularly if they have to answer to groups of investors.
Over to the proposed billion-dollar development of a Major League Soccer stadium and other things on the site of the unfinished Wayne County Jail. Gilbert's already offered $50 million for that jail site. The county has already poured $150 million into this Fecano debacle. What's fair for taxpayers here?
Well, I can tell you what Warren Evans thinks is fair. Warren Evans thinks he's the Bob Fecano's successor, and he believes that what's fair for taxpayers is getting a jail done and not costing them any more than it would cost them to finish the project on the current site. You know, I had a long talk with him yesterday, and I think he's very realistic about this. He did not dismiss this idea. In fact, I think he thinks that it could be very cool for downtown. His overriding issue is the hit the taxpayers take, and he's not prepared to ask them to shoulder additional expense just to make way for the Gilbert vision. I think what we saw yesterday was really a couple things. I characterize it as a power play, which is interesting for a basketball owner because they don't really do that. It's
right.
Kind of mixing my sports metaphors.
That's right.
But I think it was. But I think it was also something else. This was vintage Dan Gilbert. Let's take a vision. Let's make it public. Let's generate enthusiasm. Get a lot of the constituencies we need to make something like this happen rallying behind us. Downtown businesses, City Hall, the general public, the state of Michigan, who clearly wants to see this jail thing sorted out and to get them to move ahead with it, and even Wayne County, as well as the fan base of Major League Soccer and professional soccer in and around Southeast Michigan, and, it should be said, the Windsor area. This is classic for him to do this. I think it also signals that they are prepared to get down and really negotiate this thing because they don't have a lot of time. You know, Warren Evans is looking at trying to put out a new request for proposal to continue the construction by the end of summer or early fall. So we're talking about 3-4 months, then you've got all the summer breaks and things in the middle. This is something that's going to happen pretty quickly to see if they've got a go or a no-go on this whole deal.
Final question. You sat down with Warren Evans. Is he feeling strong-armed by yesterday's show with there's Dan Gilbert, there's the MLS commissioner, a representative of Piston owner Tom Gores. Was he feeling strong-armed at all by that?
Well, I used the phrase full court press and when I talked to him about it, and he acknowledged that, and he said, look, I am getting the full court press. I understand that. He's a pretty cool customer, and I think They both kind of threw out opening negotiating positions in public, which is kind of rare. They did have a meeting at 11 o'clock yesterday morning, which he goes into the meeting, and there he is with the mayor and Dan Gilbert and the commissioner of Major League Soccer and a representative of Tom Gores, the owner of the Pistons, where they laid out this whole vision. And I think any of us who put in a situation like that would think, yeah, we're being strong-armed a little bit. I don't think he kind of saw it as strong-arming. I think he kind of saw it as putting the cards on the table and like, let's get serious now, because one of the real issues has been, what is the gap here? What is the gap between what the taxpayers are prepared to pay and should be asked to pay and what moving the jail to another location would actually cost in the grand scheme of things? And I think Warren Evans' position is, whatever that gap is, taxpayers are not going to be able to pay that. You can't ask them to do that. I'm not going to ask them to do that. The private sector people pushing this thing are going to have to understand what the parameters of that are, what the gap is, and what they're prepared to cover and what they're not prepared to cover. And that's what these negotiations are really all going to be about, I think.
Some high stakes. Let's make a deal.
Yep.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is National Poetry Month, so it's a perfect time to check in with the Poet Laureate of the Upper Peninsula. Andrea Scarpino was named the laureate in 2015, and she's with us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We hear that term, poet laureate, but I'm betting a lot of us don't really know what that entails. What do you see as your role as the Upper Peninsula Poet Laureate?
Well, I think a lot of people don't know what it entails because it can mean so many different things. The U.S. Poet Laureate is a long-held position, and different poet laureates have understood it different ways. Some people have just kind of sat in their office and written a lot of poetry during their tenure as U.S. Poet Laureate. Others have really seen it as a very powerful public position to connect readers with poetry. And I think that's how I've interpreted it in the last couple of years as the UP Poet Laureate, trying to find ways to get people who maybe think they don't like poetry or have never read poetry to help them connect with poetry in an everyday basis.
What is your sales pitch, Andrea, about poetry when you're meeting people? How do you sell them on poetry?
Well, that's a great question. It's hard to do, I think, in part because we've developed this idea as a culture, and it's a very American idea, that poetry is difficult. It's something only really smart people can read. It's only done in universities, that kind of thing. So what I always try to tell people is, if you've read a poem and you don't like it, try another one, right? Mm. There are so many different kinds of poetry out there. Saying you don't like poetry is like saying you don't like music or something like that. You may not like classical music or you may not like country music, but there's some kind of music out there that you like. And I think the same of poetry, that there are so many different kinds, and American poets right now are writing in such varied ways, different formats, different styles. If you don't like one particular poet or type of poetry, try another one. You'll find one you like.
It sounds like perhaps we need to do a better job in the way we present poetry, even back in the early days in school.
I think that's right. I mean, I think sometimes we're taught that a poem is kind of the secret scavenger hunt, and the writer has hidden, secret keys along the way, and you have to uncover all of the keys or you don't get the poem. And I just think that does all of us a disservice. There's so many different kinds of poetry and so many different writers that there are very straightforward poems. There are poems that are just playing with sounds and with language. There are poems that are best to heard. There are poems that are best to see on the page. So I think we need to really think about diversity in poetry in order to grow an audience.
What have you been doing personally as the Upper Peninsula Poet Laureate to spread the word about poetry in the Upper Peninsula? You've got a lot of terrain to cover.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite projects has been a free little poetry library that I had built in the UP, entirely UP material. And it's just this little mobile library filled with poetry books that I've brought to different locations around the UP. So it's been up in Calumet and Houghton, Hancock area. It's been in Marquette. It was at the Marquette County Fair last summer. And it's an opportunity for people just to kind of be going about their everyday lives and run into some poetry and take a book if they want to, donate a book if they want to. And that's been really fun for me because when I first opened the library, I stocked it entirely with poetry books. And now when I go to restock it, it's filled with books that I did not put in there. So it's clear that people are really using it or are dropping off their own books and really enjoying it, which is fun for me. I've also done a reading series in Marquette at the Ordoc Brewing Company called Bards and Brews. I've been doing readings, across the UP. So I've been trying to kind of get out there and do readings and other really fun events that people can connect to.
What is the moment like for you when you see the aha light go on in someone's eyes and you realize, I think I've caught them?
It's really fun. You know, I think I fell in love with poetry as a little girl. I loved reading poetry before I even knew what it was, really, I think. So to be able to share the passion that I have and this love that has really carried me through many years and good times and bad times with somebody else is a complete delight for me.
I found it interesting when I learned that you actually are a transplanted Uper and you made the adjustment coming from L.A.?
Yeah, I've only been in the UP almost 6 years now, but we had been living in Los Angeles for 4 years before I moved. And, you know, I tell people all the time when I first found out I was moving to the UP, I didn't even know what it was. I had no idea where we were going. But showing up and meeting people and seeing this beautiful scenery and people were just so kind and welcoming and generous with their time was really a delightful experience. I would not claim that I'm a Uper for sure, because I think you have to be born and bred in the UP to claim that. But I'm somebody who really does love living in the Upper Peninsula, who loves Lake Superior, and who really has found a nice artistic community there.
Andrea Scarpino is the Poet Laureate of the Upper Peninsula. Andrea, thank you so much for sharing your love of poetry and speaking with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And now let's listen to a poem from another Poet Laureate. This one is from Grand Rapids. In addition to being that city's poet laureate, Lou Klatt is also a professor of English at Calvin College.
Ford, if it's all the same to you, I'd like something more than horsepower. In the 70s, I listened to service tips from a Ford dealer on the radio. It made me anxious to own a Thunderbird or lose the past in a galaxy. But when push came to shove, it was a Mazda, Japanese assembled. Fast forward to the future, to the yachts of Grand Traverse, where Chicagoans from the Gold Coast are insane for our lakefronts. It's true that the high and mighty are mired in foreclosure. You got to feel for the jet set. That puts me in mind of high school, when Led Zeppelin ruled the airwaves. Transport is fickle. One of the first Fords, the 999, shot across ice like an arrow, but also killed its test driver. Glaciers. They tiptoed interstate with nary an engine.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Next time you tune into your favorite show on the Food Network, be it The Pioneer Woman or Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives or Cupcake Masters, take a moment and thank Jack Clifford. Jack Clifford was the so-so student at Ottawa Hills High School in Grand Rapids, voted by his classmates as least likely to succeed. What did they know? Jack Clifford is the founder of the Food Network, and he tells his fascinating life story in a book titled The Least Likely to Succeed. Jack Clifford, welcome to Stateside.
Well, my pleasure, dear.
Now, you really were not on the fast track to success at Ottawa Hills High School, were you?
No, I was pretty much in the opposite direction. The only reason I stayed in high school was by the pressure of my sister, who was 11 years older than I and graduated from Ottawa Hills, and by Elmo Waringa, the new principal there my senior year. Elmo took a liking to me and encouraged me that I could do better than the C average I had and I should go to college, and eventually he talked me into it.
And I love the way you describe in your book what happened after your senior classmates voted you least likely to succeed, and he came up, and what did he say to you that really changed your mind about where you were going to go?
Well, he was sympathetic, and he said, that wasn't very nice, was it? And I said, no, I didn't think so, but who knows, maybe they're right. And then he really lectured me, and he said, Jack, he said, you got it if you're willing to work at school, and you need college. If anybody ever needed a successful college career, you need it now, because that's the only way you're going to get ahead and show these people they're wrong. And he kept after me, and eventually I went to college.
And you were the first in your family to get a college degree when you graduated from Western Michigan.
That's right. And another point is I paid my own way. I didn't have grades to get scholarships, so I had to pay for it. But I worked full-time all the way through college.
And then went on to get into broadcasting. I know you were a disc jockey and you were then a TV sportscaster in the 50s, but you wound up working with the Providence Journal Company eventually. And boy, did that put you in a good position to decide to launch a cable network.
Yes. So I became the head of broadcasting and non-newspaper operations for the Providence Journal Company in Providence, Rhode Island, and that was in 1977. And together with and they're a wonderful company, by the way, absolutely wonderful company. They're the oldest daily published newspaper in the United States, having published their first newspaper in 1828, and continuous publishing ever since.
Well, Jack, take us up to the early 90s, and what gave you this idea that there needed to be a cable network that was all about food? Because I know, it's pretty mind-boggling to think that when the Food Network went on the air in November 1993, it was just an incredibly novel idea.
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm an amateur chef. I love to cook. I love to bake. I make pies and breads, and I always have and enjoy that enormously. And I, having come from the production side, basically, of television and radio, I saw guys like my pals in that business, specifically Ted Turner, who became a close, very close friend, still is, he never owned a cable system, but he made more money out of cable than anybody by providing content for cable. And what it suddenly struck me, which it should have long before it did, was that people aren't watching cable, they're watching content. Just happens to come to them through cable. So I looked around for what was yet available. There were plenty of sports channels. There were plenty of news channels. You name it, women's channels, men's channels, but there was no food channel. So I did some research and found out that, by golly, that would be could be a very successful network. So I talked with Julia Childs and others who were already on in public television, and they felt that it was a good idea, and so we went ahead with it, and I talked my company into funding the startup, and we acquired strategic partners who had cable systems and wanted to be in programming as well, but didn't have the skill that I had because they never had been in that side of the business. So they hired me. In essence, I put together a partnership. I was the general partner, and these other cable operators were limited partners. And we went up on the cable satellite in 1993, and that's when we began, and it just blossomed.
Well, and here you are. It is still going strong with a mind-boggling array of programs. Why do you think the Food Network not only lasted, as you say, it blossomed? It's a mainstay of cable viewing for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the reason why is that, well, simply put, we all eat if we want to survive, and we like to have good food and have fun with food. And the research that I did, I didn't do it individually. I hired a company to do it, came back and said, this is going to be huge. Everybody is going to watch this. They won't watch it 24 hours a day, but they'll watch it because it's fun. Everybody loves the kitchen. Everybody, you throw a party at your house, cocktail party. Where do they all wind up? In the kitchen. I don't know why that is, but it is. So they said, you should go ahead with this. I talked my company into that idea. They backed me in it, and well, you know the rest.
We do indeed. Well, and back to your Ottawa High School principal. You're actually honoring him by creating a scholarship fund at Grand Rapids Community Foundation. What do you hope this scholarship will do?
Well, we've been doing it now for 14 years, and we've had 56 kids go to college. These are kids that don't have the economic capability, just as I didn't, and had to work or to find some way to get a scholarship to help them through college. So we determined that we would get good kids that needed help, and we would put them through college as best we could. And it's been very successful. We have had enormous success with it. Most of the kids that get the scholarship, it's a four-year scholarship, but it has to be renewed every year. They can't just limp over to the next year. They've got to meet certain standards. And they do, and many, 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 many of them have graduated.
What kind of success stories stick in your mind? What have some of them gone on to do, Jack?
Well, many have gone on to teach a school, are in business. We have now, for the first time last year, we added one of the students that we gave a scholarship to some years ago to our committee that picks these kids. And that's the Grand Rapids Community Foundation organization that handles all of this. So we've put 56 kids, or at least most of them finished it up and got their degrees, and we now have the first graduate of that program on our committee. And we're the only one that I know of in that foundation, only scholarship, that actually meets every year in May and interviews the candidates for that scholarship personally.
You know, I think about your book, The Least Likely to Succeed, and what you have gone on to do with your life, such a rich life, and you know, founding the Food Network is just one of many accomplishments. I'm hearing a pretty great life lesson here. Do not let the views of your classmates dictate who you are or who you should be.
Well, that's true. I think that the inspiration, if there is any, is say yes, don't say no. When somebody comes up to you with a good idea, just say, yes, we'll do that. And I always did that in my business life, and look what it led to. You know, I had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life. So I think if you just think of it in terms of say yes, if you say no, everything ends. If you say yes, at least you got a chance to find out what might come of it. So my theory is say yes, and then work like hell to make sure it comes through.
Jack Clifford will be in Grand Rapids this coming Sunday at Schuller Books and Music, and he'll be signing his book, The Least Likely to Succeed. That's at 3 o'clock this coming Sunday, May 1st. Jack Clifford, it was such a treat to talk with you. We want to thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful that you took time out to talk to me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea.
When we really see each other. We want to help each other.
There are many ways to improve life in Michigan through innovation and entrepreneurism. Certainly, business, science, technology, they're all a part of that story. But so are the arts. Our latest guest on The Next Idea recently received an entrepreneurship prize from the University of Michigan for her role in co-founding Girls Rock Detroit. It blends music camp with a strong message of empowerment and aims it right at girls. Melissa Coppola is a graduating master's level piano student at Michigan and co-founder of Girls Rock Detroit. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. And we are happy to welcome one of the Girls Rock Detroit campers. She's 11 years old. She's a sixth grader at Clegg Middle School in Ann Arbor. Mira Ramaswamy is with us. So happy that you're with us, Mira.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with exactly what is Girls Rock Detroit, mm-hmm. Melissa?
Girls Rock Detroit is a summer camp for girls between ages 8 and 16. And what we do is we provide them all with instruments, and we teach them how to play those instruments, put them into bands, teach them how to songwrite, and then they perform those songs at the end of the camp with a giant showcase for their friends and family.
So we don't necessarily have to have people that have been doing an instrument. You're going to really kind of take people by the hand and take these girls and bring them into the world of music.
Yes, absolutely. I think that we believe that by empowering girls with music education, they can learn how to express themselves in alternative ways. And most girls don't have access to an instrument. In fact, in rock music, a lot of girls aren't encouraged to pick up a rock instrument. It's really more of a boy thing a lot of the times. So we like to put instruments in their hands and we say, you can do it. And we teach them just the very basics. And all you need is really just an instrument and your voice and to express yourself on that way on a stage.
And where do your girls come from?
Most of the girls come from Detroit. So this year we had more than 50% of the campers come from Detroit. And most of them were from Wayne County, though we did have campers like Mira from Ann Arbor. We got about 50 applications for 25 spots. So it was very, very well received. We weren't expecting it to be so popular.
Now, I'm curious, Melissa, what made someone who is already busy enough with her own college workload, I mean, you're wrapping up your graduate studies at Michigan, what made you say, no, you know what, this is something I want to bring to Michigan?
I was actually, when I was in school in 2010, I heard about the Girls Rock Camp Alliance when I was down in North Carolina for a show that I wanted to see. And they explained that Girls Rock Camp Alliance is actually a national organization that unites all the different camps across the nation with a similar mission to empower girls with music education. And I was just so taken by the idea because I've always loved rock music. My dad's a huge rock music fan. I grew up listening to the Beatles and to the Eagles and all different sorts of music, and I was just super taken by the idea. So I went to volunteer for a bunch of different camps. I've volunteered in Iowa City. I helped them launch their first camp. I've also volunteered in Chicago as well as North Carolina. And Chicago is where I met my co-founders.
So you said, let's do this and let's get it up and running
Yes.
in Southeast Michigan. Mira, what made you decide you wanted to go to this camp?
Well, I really liked music and rock and roll. It was always like something that I enjoyed. I listened to it on the radio a lot, and when I was 5, I had like a rock and roll birthday party. It was like really fun.
So did you have an instrument? Did you play anything before you went to the camp, or did you learn everything anew in the camp?
I played trombone in school, but I know a little bit of acoustic guitar, and I play piano, but...
That said rock. So what did the camp do? When you went to the camp and you were there with other girls your age and people were making music, what was that like?
It was really fun because you got to meet all these new campers that are from different areas and that are much different from you. And I made a lot of friends there, and we did a lot of empowerment things.
Yeah. Because that's part of this, isn't it, Melissa, where it's we're going to make music, but it's about empowerment. So it's feminism and helping these young women understand their own strength.
Yes, absolutely.
How so? What do you do?
The camp is only 5 days long, so it's really quite a whirlwind. You know, we get them in on the first day. We put instruments in their hands. We pair them in the bands. We say, go write songs. So while it's very overwhelming for them, it's also really awesome for us because with that shock factor the first day, those girls come in the second day and they're ready to work. They're like, all right, let's write this song. Let's learn how to play our instruments. It's really awesome.
So what kind of transformations do you see, Melissa, over these 5 days?
I have seen most of the girls, I can say probably for every girl that comes in on the first day and the last day, there's an incredible transformation. Most of their girls come in really shy, not wanting to talk to anybody. And through icebreaker activities and just the camp in general, day one versus day six on the showcase, it's incredible. I mean, seeing the girls backstage getting their faces painted and getting ready, like their show faces on, getting ready to go on the stage, it's amazing.
I'm watching Mira smile with happiness as you talk about. What did you learn about yourself, Mira, in that time in camp?
I learned I really like to play, I play bass guitar, so I learned I really like to play that instrument, and I want to like try it more. And maybe in the future I could like make my own rock band. I don't know.
Melissa, how does Girls Rock Detroit represent arts entrepreneurship, do you think?
I think that Girls Rock in general and Girls Rock camps everywhere are such a unique idea. And it's a very, very special camp that is such a unique environment. You really can't find this anywhere else. And I think it's something that Detroit really needed. And girls around here, I thought, would really, really benefit from it. And my team and I really worked super hard to just make sure that it got started in Detroit, because we believe that once the enthusiasm there is there, and once the awareness is there for this type of camp to empower girls to play rock music, it really is self-sustaining. So I think that with the community support, it can really be perpetual.
And where do you want to take this idea? I mean, right now you're meeting for your camps, but I'm sure you have long-range plans.
Yes. So we have much bigger plans for the camp. This year, our main goal was to solidify our instrument inventory, because we provide all the girls with instruments. We do need to buy a lot of instruments. This year, we operated under a loan situation, so we ended up borrowing most of the instruments, but we do need to buy them and complete our inventory. But my personal dream is to expand this to an after-school program. It just requires so many educators to be involved. I think it's a 5-year plan, but I would love to expand it to an after-school program that's maybe a 10-week or a 12-week program rather than just 5 days, and then to have a showcase based on what those girls are working on in school as an after-school event.
You can learn more about Girls Rock Detroit by going to their website, girlsrockdetroit.org. Co-founder Melissa Coppola and camper Mira Ramaswamy, thank you so much for sharing Girls Rock Detroit with us, and good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This poetry is feeling good, so let's head to the break with another one. Earlier, we heard from UP poet laureate Andrea Scarpino. So here is an excerpt from her book-length poem called What the Willow Said as It Fell.
And what of the willow tree, 100 years beside the lake? Girls played in its long-armed cape, braided branches like hair. Mothers turned its switches into pain. Mallard ducks, mute swans, geese built nests with matted leaves. Night of the hurricane, my child body asleep. Sideways rain, lightning, one long, loud crack, and the willow split in two, one half in the lake, one half through the roof, broken windows, plaster knocked from the walls. What the willow said as it fell, "Take this body, make it whole." And I woke with a crown of leaf and limb, bark-thickened skin, sap down my arms, salicin, aspirin. What is remembered in the body is well remembered. Mother's voice through my room's darkness, part crying out, part inhaled breath.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A quick follow-up for you to a story that we brought early last month. You may recall there was strong reaction when the owner of 98-year-old pipelines running under the St. Clair River made a change of permit request that seemed to indicate they might want to transport oil under the river between Marysville and Sarnia, Ontario. Well, now comes word the company, Plains LPG, has withdrawn that request and with that has evidently tabled the possibility of shipping heavy crude oil under the St. Clair River. Let us talk about Cuba. You can bet Michigan agriculture businesses are mighty intrigued at the prospect of doing business with Cuba after the Obama administration reestablished formal ties with the island nation. And the feeling is mutual. Cuba sees the U.S. as a potential new market. In the first story in our series, Pure Cuba Opportunities for Michigan, Tracy Samilton reports there are still many obstacles standing in the way of increased agricultural trade.
Finca Marta is not a typical Cuban farm. The organic farm lies about an hour away from Havana. It was established in 2008 by a former agriculture researcher, Fernando Funes. A biodigester turns manure into methane used at the farmhouse for cooking. Funes says the irrigation system relies on renewable energy.
And now the solar pump is pumping here, so we are combining the old-fashioned well with the new technology, pumping water with the sun.
There are many terraces of raised beds, some with screens to block the hot Cuban sun.
The idea is that we make all the beds like this one, and the soil that is here is going to be more and more improved every year.
This highly productive farm will be supplying 25 Havana restaurants and their hordes of tourist customers with fresh vegetables and herbs by the end of the year. But, like I said, it's not typical. When U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack toured farms in Cuba last year, he was not terribly impressed.
Well, I think the word I would use to describe Cuban agriculture is very basic and rudimentary.
Although Cuba has large-scale tobacco and sugarcane farms, most of its more typical food-producing farms are small. If a farmer's lucky enough to have a tractor, it's likely to be at least 30 years old. Many other farmers till their fields with oxen or even by hand. The majority of Cuban farms are notoriously unproductive as a result. Pesticides and herbicides are very expensive, so by default, many farms are raising crops organically. Vilsack says that represents an opportunity.
Their land, I think, could be well suited for organic production, organic citrus fruits and organic fruits and vegetables, of which there is an increasingly large demand here in the U.S. and around the world.
And in return, Vilsack says American farmers could sell more rice, black beans, milk, and poultry to Cuba's centralized government, which has to import as much as 80% of the country's food. Cuban agriculture experts told us this sounds like a fine plan, but increasing yields on the country's 200,000 small farms to produce local crops for Cubans and tourists has to come first. Meanwhile, the uncertainty hasn't deterred U.S. agriculture groups from sending out scouts, like Jim Byram of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. As he knows well, a staple of the Cuban diet is black beans.
We grow more black beans in Michigan than any other state in the Union. Currently, Cuba's buying them from either South America or China, and we think it makes sense for them to look here.
Still, Byram is a realist. He says trade with Cuba is often stymied by the embargo, which doesn't permit the country to buy U.S. goods on credit. And he says Americans shouldn't expect Cuba to open its wallet unilaterally.
It needs to be a two-way street. It's not just sell, 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 because they don't have a lot of money, money, money.
While political resistance to lifting the embargo remains, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack sees it being chipped away every day.
And particularly agriculture is leading the effort because we see the wisdom of doing business with the Cubans. So I think it's just a matter of time.
Cubans are especially eager for an end to the embargo. It's hoped that will mean more food on their own tables, as well as on the plates of tourists. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
Mercedes Mejia contributed to this report. This is truly the 11th hour for an Ypsilanti mother and her 16-year-old daughter. Without intervention by the Immigration Board of Appeals, Susana Bernabe Ramirez and her daughter Sarah Hernandez must be on a one-way flight to Mexico tomorrow morning. And Susana will be forced to leave her 11-year-old daughter Isabella behind. That's because the girl was born here in the United States, so she is a citizen, and she has epilepsy, so she needs the medical care that she can get right here in Michigan. The potential deportation of this mother and her daughter has ignited great sympathy in Washtenaw County. With us now is the family and their immigration attorney, Brad Thompson. Brad, help us understand how Susana and Sarah came to be in this dilemma facing deportation tomorrow morning.
Susana and her family were in the United States originally from 2001 until 2010 when Susana's mother became very sick, and so the family went back to help take care of Susana's mother. While they were living in Mexico, they started suffering from threats of extortion to the point where they had to pay 75% of their wages to the cartel, with death being the ultimate sentence if you don't pay these extortion fees. To make matters more complicated, Isabella has epilepsy, and if she has a seizure, she's required to get on this medication, which was extremely difficult to get in the state where she was from, and so they would have to get the medication in Mexico City. Ultimately got to a point where it was economically impossible to survive where they were. So their family, that being Susana and her two daughters, traveled up to the border at Tijuana, went to the Border Patrol and requested asylum here in the United States.
Based on having faced these extortion threats.
Correct.
And we should note when they came in 2001, when she came in 2001, that was not she did not have documentation at the time.
Correct. They entered without inspection at that point. So at the border, they were interviewed and found to have a credible fear, and they were paroled into the United States and provided immigration court paperwork to show up in immigration court. That's where I came into the picture, being their immigration attorney, where we presented our asylum application in the Detroit Immigration Court. In the Detroit Immigration Court, the immigration judge found the testimony credible, which typically is the toughest challenge in the immigration court. And specifically, the judge said in his decision that he wished he could help, but unfortunately he has to follow the authority of the Board of Immigration Appeals, which states that victims of extortion are not a protected social group for asylum purposes.
All right. So they asked for asylum, and according to the letter of the law, extortion doesn't qualify you, even though the judge that where the case was presented said, I'm completely understanding of this need to stay.
That is correct. In fact, the exact language was the judge to Mrs. Bernabe. The judge said, I understand that this day is very disappointing for you. I frankly wish the law weren't different in cases like yours. I do believe that you fear returning to your country, and I think it's a legitimate fear. And I also know that you are looking out for the best interests of the child who is not in the courtroom. As I say, I wish there was something different that I could do.
So the clock is ticking without some kind of action from the Immigration Board of Appeals, Immigration Appeals Court.
Correct. What makes this case extremely interesting from a lawyer point of view is the Board of Immigration Appeals issued a decision April 18th, 2016, just last week, that states that a particular social group for asylum purposes that qualifies for asylum is a working class single woman in Michoacan. That is the state where Susanna and her family are from. The facts, circumstances in our case are strikingly similar to the facts in that case. As a result, we have put a motion to reopen into the Board of Immigration Appeals. I was on the phone with them a couple hours ago, and we should be getting a decision later on this afternoon whether they are going to stay the removal so that the Board of Immigration Appeals can decide whether this case merits reopening and sending it back down to the Detroit Immigration Court for the immigration judge to review the case.
Where the immigration judge said, I wish I could do more.
Correct.
Sara, how does it feel to think that you and your mom may have to be on a plane tomorrow back to Mexico and leaving your little sister behind?
It's very devastating. I don't think anybody would like to be separated from their family. How would you feel if you would be separated from your family?
What do you remember about your time in Mexico?
At some point, it was scary. I mean, Mexico is beautiful, but unfortunately, there's places where it really is dangerous to a point where your life is in danger.
What would happen with your little sister if you wind up having to go back? What happens for Isabella?
She would have to stay here.
With who?
With paternal grandparents.
You've been quoted as saying that this case has just been unlike anyone you've handled, Brad. Why has this case gotten to you so strongly?
For starters, because Susanna is one of the most beautiful mothers I've ever seen. Also, in my opinion, she's the poster for the perfect immigrant. She's always paid her taxes. She has been completely honest, not only with me, but all the border officials, the immigration judge. And it's a heartbreaking case to see a single mother being potentially permanently separated from her daughter. The other interesting aspect of this case is on November 20, 2014, Immigration and Customs Enforcement issued a memo, and in the memo they put three different groups of priorities for deportation. Miss Bernabe Ramirez falls into priority three, because she has a final order of removal after January 2014. Upon reading the memo, the exact language of the memo states that priority three aliens are those who have been issued a final order of removal on or after January 1st, 2014. And aliens described in this priority who are not also described in priority one or two represent the third and lowest priority for apprehension and removal. Resources should be dedicated accordingly to aliens in this priority. Priority three aliens should generally be removed unless they qualify for asylum or another form of relief under our laws, or unless, in the judgment of an immigration officer, the alien is not a threat to the integrity of the immigration system or there are factors suggesting that the alien should not be an enforcement priority.
I can tell you feel that she ticks all the boxes here. That's why you're fighting so hard.
Absolutely. We've been in contact with both senators. Both Senator Stabenow and Senator Peters have provided a letter of support requesting that Immigration and Customs Enforcement do not enforce removal in this case. We even got in communication with Carl Levin, who went out of his way to do everything within his power to help out in this decision.
Brad, if you don't get that decision that you're hoping for and these two women wind up on a plane to Mexico with a one-way ticket, what options legally exist for you and for them after that?
Well, a couple of years ago, there was a Court of Appeals decision that says that motions to reopen still stay valid. So if we win on the motion to reopen, then we can potentially have a chance at this case. However, it does not guarantee that Susanna and Sara will be able to get back into the country. For example, on the last motion to reopen that I had, my client, our motion was pending before the Board of Immigration Appeals. He was deported. We won the motion to reopen 9 days after he was deported, and ICE refused to let him come back into the country to testify in his court hearing.
So I can tell you feel this is just critical to kind of get this in motion before they have to get on this plane.
Absolutely. We've done everything within our power, and I have to give a special thank you to the community. They've really come together, not only in providing support to the senators and Immigration and Customs Department, but really being there for the family to show them that we care about them.
Senator, Brad mentioned your mother has been working. She's been paying taxes. Tell us about her work schedule on a given day.
Her work schedules are from 8 to 4. She works at KFC Taco Bell. From there, she comes home, only rests for like about 5, 6, 7 until 1 in the morning. And she goes to clean a movie theater. And she stays there about 4 or 5, and then she comes back home, sleeps for about 3 hours, and wakes up again and goes to work.
Susana, the community all around Washtenaw County has really rallied behind you and your family, and they are so hoping to keep you here and keep you together. What has that support meant for you?
Pues la verdad significa mucho. Yo estoy muy, muy agradecida.
Well, it means a lot to me. I'm very grateful to all the people who are helping me. I really did not expect this much support from the community.
It must be very hard to think that you may be in a position of having to leave your little girl behind here. How will you be able to do that if that has to happen?
That's a very difficult question. For me, it's very difficult to be separated from her. But I'd rather she stay here for some time because it's hard for her to get the medication she needs back home. She's also been in dangerous situations. One time there was a shootout, and we had to hide under the table. And for those reasons, I prefer she stay here, even though all of this is very difficult for me.
And Brad, you know, and I'm sure you've heard it from those who will say, well, you know, look, it goes back to the decision that this family made to enter without documents back in 2001. How do you answer that?
Sometimes in life, people don't have a decision. They have to do what they need to do to survive. For that reason, I'm an immigration attorney, because for me, I try to look across the borders and look at what's best for the family and the community and the economy of the United States of America.
Brad Thompson, immigration attorney from Ann Arbor, Susana Bernabe Ramirez, and her daughter, Sara Hernandez, could be deported back to Mexico tomorrow morning without action by the Board of Appeals. We wish you a lot of luck, and thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Lester Graham will be here tomorrow. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.